pandemic, in the scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudovirus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Heiren Cho and Michael Farzan, researchers. This article is published under the heading How SARS-CoV-2 First Adapted in Humans. Stay tuned for more. Viruses need entry proteins to penetrate the cells where they will replicate. The severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 SARS-CoV-2 version is called the spike or S protein. The S protein, also target of the current vaccines, is quickly adapting to its new human host. It took its first major step in this direction early in 2020 when its amino acid 614 changed from an aspartic acid to a glycine. Viruses bearing this D614 G mutation transmit among humans more rapidly and now form the majority in circulation. Early in the pandemic, in a scramble to create tools to study SARS-CoV-2, investigators developed pseudovirus systems to measure infection in a safe, easily quantifiable way. These systems express a viral entry protein on the surface of a reporter virus used to monitor cell entry and have been used for years to study many such proteins, including the S protein of classic SARS-CoV-1. Frustratingly, pseudoviruses built from the SARS-CoV-2 S protein produce much lower signals than those based on the very similar SARS-CoV-1 S protein. This was perplexing because biochemical studies of SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 S protein receptor binding domains RBDs made clear that the SARS-CoV-2 RBD bound their common receptor, angiotensin converting enzyme 2, with higher affinity than that of SARS-CoV-1. Faced with inefficient assays, many virologists landed on the same solution as their structural biology colleagues. Mutate the S protein site that is cleaved by ferrin-like proteases in virus-producing cells. This change kept the S protein S1 domain, which contains the RBD and binds ACE2, covalently linked to its S2 domain, which anchors the S protein to the virion. Notably, some but not all of these ferrin site mutations significantly improved pseudovirus infection of cells. This fix solved a technical problem, but it deepened a mystery. Although a number of distantly related coronaviruses carry ferrin cleavage sites at their S1, S2 boundaries, the SARS-CoV-1 S protein and those of all known bat-derived viruses from the same SARB virus lineage lack this site. Instead of being cleaved in virus-producing cells, their S proteins are cleaved by different proteases while the virus is engaging ACE2 in the next yet-to-be-infected cell. As it happens, varying site mutations that improve SARS-CoV-2 S-protein function in pseudoviruses allowed the modified S-protein to work with these later-stage enzymes, just like the SARS-CoV-1 version. Why then did the SARS-CoV-2 varying site persist, even though it made infection in cell culture less efficient? Indeed, viruses passaged in culture regularly lost this site. Does it somehow improve viral transmission? Would it eventually disappear over the course of the pandemic? In the summer of 2020, Korber et al. Sounded an alarm about a mutation of concern, namely D614G. In the lab, this change obviated the need to eliminate the S-protein varying site, apparently correcting a design flaw associated with this unusual cleavage site. Animal studies with otherwise identical viruses showed markedly greater replication of the D614G variant in the upper respiratory tract, a site important for transmission. By contrast, no significant differences between the two viruses were seen in the lower respiratory tract, a site responsible for more severe disease. These observations are consistent with the current consensus that D614G, now present in most circulating viruses, enhances viral transmission, but unlike more recent acquired transmissions in S1, it does not change the rate of hospitalizations. The underlying mechanism for this fitness advantage remained a point of controversy. Here, a second unusual property of the S-protein, in this case shared with SARS-CoV-1, became relevant. The SARS-CoV-2 S-protein, like most interproteins of viruses with a lipid membrane, assembles into trimers. Typically, during the process of variant assembly, viral interproteins subtly change their confrontations. But it is unusual for these proteins to break their threefold symmetry before they bind their receptor. However, the mature SARS-CoV-2 S-protein often assumes an asymmetrical arrangement whereby one of its three RBDs assumes an open or up conformation. Only RBDs in this up conformation can bind ACE2. Once it does so, the S1 domain dissociates from S2, and S2 undergoes a pronounced rearrangement to a post-fusion state. The release energy of this rearrangement drives the viral and cell membranes to fuse and gives the virus access to the cell interior. To explain D614G fitness, some investigators focus on the impact of D614G on the frequency with which this one-up conformation could be found, suggesting that more efficient engagement of the receptor accounted for the enhanced transmissibility of viruses bearing this mutation. Other scientists noted that S-proteins of D614G expressing viruses fell apart less frequently, an effect perhaps amplified in the challenging environment of a living organism. They observed that D614G helped the S1 domain cling to S2, preventing S2 from prematurely and unproductively assuming its post-fusion conformation. Thus, the virus had more functional S-proteins that could bind and infect the next cell. To cut through this controversy, Zhang, the expert in this domain, solved the structure and provided detailed analysis of both D614 and G614 S-proteins in multiple states. They first noted that, as they and others had previously observed, the loss of D614 614 in S1 breaks an ionic bond to a proximal lysine, K854 in S2. Loss of this salt bridge is initially counterintuitive because it will loosen the association between S1 and S2, although it might ease the movement of the RBD into the up configuration. However, the structures from Zhang et al. Show that a major difference between S proteins with and without D614G is the visibly greater ordering in G614S proteins of a region spanning residence 602 to 640, which authors call the 630 loop. This loop is just downstream of G614.
Inside Israel.
While economic and health experts in Israel weigh in daily on how to save the Israelis medically and financially, there is little talk regarding a consequence of the virus that could cause the most damage: mental health. Over 1.2 million Israeli adults reported deterioration in mental and emotional state, but that figure was for the first lockdown. Now, researchers report a 40% increase in that number for a total of 1,680,000.
The first is social distancing and the quarantine. Many people are alone now, and alone for long periods of time and isolated. Depression and anxiety, we've been seeing a lot of these people getting worse, and also people without pre-existing issues. It's just a problem.
The issue of mental disorders in Israel is not new. Unfortunately, it was never properly addressed by authorities, as no funds were allocated to it. And now, with the current political chaos and budget deadlock, it seems highly unlikely that the regime would pay attention to this problem.
People are out of jobs, people don't have enough money.
Even in the military, Israelis who are drafted there fake mental health disorders just to go AWOL from the military. We are talking about 1/3 of the Israeli males and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. Mati Kaspi, one of Israel's leading musicians, posted a message on his Facebook page announcing that he and his family were leaving Israel in order to protect their mental health. He blames the Israeli regime for what he called the sad situation the regime creates for its citizens and culture. Mental health experts are warning of another epidemic in Israel. They say that the emotional and psychological impact of the coronavirus pandemic are no less severe than the havoc wreaked on Israel's health system and the economy. Psychologist Eled Mardo of Haifa University, who is behind the study, reports a 300% increase in requests for psychological treatment. The data shows that 25% of Israelis over the age of 21, that is approximately 1.2 million people, report a deterioration in their mental and emotional state after lockdown. This, while 26% say the emotional state of their children has taken a turn for the worse. According to the professor behind the study, these are catastrophic numbers. The issue of mental health in Israel is not new. It has always been a social issue that the regime never really found a cure for. Israelis do not seek help because there are few problems. Many people do not seek out mental health services. Mental health services cost money, and as people feel the extended economic strain, mental health support is often viewed as non-essential. About 87% of Israelis with mental health issues stated that they simply could not afford to seek help for their mental health, according to a report published by the American Psychological Association. Due to almost non-existent programs amidst the political chaos and budget deadlock, there is no support for the unemployed to relieve the most severe economic distress. Steps to address the mental health issues in Israel are not being taken so correctly. Researchers point out to the lack of educational campaigns among Israelis regarding identification of mental health problems and appropriate use of mental health services offered by the health plans. Israelis are unaware of what is available.
First of all, a lot of doctors that could provide some kind of assistance or first diagnosis, family doctors, general physicians, were not available at that time. And for a while, you couldn't reach the mental health clinics. And there was a big confusion at the beginning why you couldn't reach psychologists and mental health workers. That was one source. People were locked down at home. And that caused both social isolation and a lot of anxiety among people. People didn't know what was going on. In addition, bear in mind that people were detached from and disconnected from their communities, from their schools, from their everyday life. And all that caused a lot of stress and a lot of times depression as well. So that could explain some rise in mental health states. Showing up in himself, in person, showing up in prime time and addressing the nation. But the way he addressed it, I believe, caused more panic. He wanted to make sure that people take care of themselves, maintain social distance, maintain hygiene, wear masks, although at the beginning people say it's not helpful at all, and then suddenly it became helpful. As time went by, people expressed more anxiety, I believe, due to those conferences, the daily conferences. You felt that things are changing constantly, that the decision makers often are not sure about how to handle this issue. They were learning the issue themselves. And the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. It was not an issue at all. People were worried about physical health and breaking the chains of contagion. And so the issue of mental health was not addressed at all. You know, and some we had some leaders saying also, you know, that just go out and have fun, don't worry about it. This issue was not considered at all until it was a huge pressure from public services, psychological public services, that started stressing that the issue of mental health and mental wellness will be addressed as well. This issue was not handled at all.
Social media, here's what users said. Norian said, little is known about the Israeli Jews suffering in Israel under their right-wing regime, children being taken from parents. An estimated 200 fathers a year have killed themselves. I heard this in a podcast from an Israeli activist. There is much poverty. All people deserve humanity. Yossi Bernstein says, she bets more women will suffer from domestic violence than the virus. Priya says, world's first psychiatric corona ward has opened in Israel. I had predicted this would happen. Corona will eventually go away, but people need to keep their minds sane. It's a mental challenge for the world.
great political instability in Israel right now, and the coronavirus is being used as a political tool, for instance, to shut down demonstrations in front of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's whose home. The politicization of this COVID crisis is causing great anxiety among Israeli people, and Israeli people have good cause to question the actions of their government, even the legitimacy of their government.
The issue of mental disorders is prevalent in the Israeli military as well. In fact, 1/3 of the Israeli males and 44% of females avoid being drafted into the military for mental health reasons. To avoid the mandatory service, Israelis rely on a military law that allows recruits to receive an exemption on grounds of medical or health issues. According to Israeli law, any individual whose health standards is less than 21 points is exempted from the military service. Some pretend to be suffering from poor mental health or disability to score low grades, an act seen as extremely dangerous by Israeli authorities. The mental health crisis in Israel is impacting all sectors and parts of Israeli society. An Israeli crisis hotline says it is receiving an unprecedented level of suicidal calls, and many of them are from people who did not have any previous diagnosed mental health issues before the pandemic started. According to the nonprofit organization that is supported by the health ministry, Iran, since the onset of the coronavirus crisis, some 5,500 Israelis who are considering ending their lives have made contact. According to Iran, it took 240,000 emergency calls since the pandemic started. About 60% of these calls are about dealing with daily challenges, financial and employment problems, mental health, and identity crises. The organization stated that 86% of inquiries come from people in crisis, or what it called emotional overload. So far, according to the organization, there is no end to these numbers in sight.
In recent years, we've seen reports that there is an increase in Israeli youngsters trying to avoid drafting by reporting all kinds of mental health and other issues. About half of them, about 44% of them, were ultra-Orthodox, what we call Haredim, and about pretty much the same number, about 46%, were secular. In some groups in Israeli society, it became unfashionable to go to the military. I don't think it's necessarily a result of mental health problems among young people, partly, which I'll discuss in a minute, but also that it became not such a problem, not such a stigma. In Israel, not serving in the army because it just doesn't fit me anymore, and I'm not too crazy about military service, and it'll take 2 or 3 years of my life. I believe that having policies that change constantly, that are clearly affected by political issues, and decisions are not based on professional expert opinions are very difficult to digest and to be accepted. When you see that the entire country is in lockdown, while actually only certain cities are red cities because of a high percentage of sick people, but the entire country goes into lockdown because certain groups oppose closing down just those cities, you understand that there's little professional advice involved in this issue. And therefore, the trust in one's government, in policymakers, in decision makers, in high-ranking officials, has deteriorated dramatically. And therefore, you don't know whom to believe. when different ministries are fighting with each other, Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Treasure.
On social media, here's what users said. Medusa is done, says she's sick of war and the endless glorification of war and military violence. In Israel, so many kids are gung-ho about going into combat units and end up with PTSD and massive mental health issues for the rest of their lives, but no one talks about that. Marwa says, how about Israel pays reparations for the mental health of Lebanese who endured its terrorism and still do down south? Jonathan says, if Israel cared about the mental health of its soldiers, it would stop making them be an occupying force that denies the humanity of other people.
Some people don't agree with the service in the army, but it's a tiny, tiny minority. There is a minority of people who do not want to serve in the army for religious reasons. But there is a small, tiny minority of people who feel that they cannot serve in the Israeli army for various reasons. Some of them might be political, but it's a tiny minority. You have to understand that the people usually serve in the Israeli army willingly and not so much under duress. However, there is a small minority, a very small number, less than 1% or even less than that, who might opt for a release from the army under some kind of mental health suggestion. But this is a tiny, tiny group of people.
Researchers warn that the problem of mental health will persist with or without coronavirus because of the lack of innovative interventions. People, according to experts, need to receive appropriate mental health services, but it is almost impossible due to the limitations related to the economic, social, and technological barriers. The health ministry and the regime are not reaching out by the technology available to Israelis for their mental health care. Given Israel's multi-ethnic society, information is not communicated in a linguistically and culturally appropriate manner, researchers found. This means that the regime and bureaucracy are not using the language used by many Israelis to communicate with them. It only uses the official Hebrew language. Also, religious leaders and organizations play a prominent role in Israeli society and serve as trusted sources of mental health information and referrals. Technically, there are no too limited efforts being made to facilitate the religious and mental health care sectors working more closely together. This leaves the average Israeli citizen with mental health problems wondering how they can seek help in a helpless society.
It's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Research data from 732 locations in 43 countries spread across every inhabited continent has revealed that, on average, 37% of all heat-related deaths can be attributed directly to global warming. We have prepared for you an article written by Prashasti Singh. The piece is titled, New Study Shows Global Warming Blamed for 1 in 3 Heat-Related Deaths. The article has been taken from the website of Agence France-Presse News Agency. Researchers said on Monday, 31st of May, that more than a third of summer heat-related fatalities are due to climate change, warning of even higher death tolls as global temperatures continue to climb. Previous research on how climate change affects human health has mostly projected future risks from heat waves, droughts, wildfires, and other extreme events made worse by global warming. How much worse depends on how quickly humanity curbs carbon dioxide emissions, which hit record levels in 2019 but dipped sharply during the coronavirus pandemic. But the authors say a new study by an international team of 70 experts is one of the first and the largest to look at health consequences that have already happened. The findings, published in Nature Climate Change, were stark. Data from 732 locations in 43 countries spread across every inhabited continent revealed that, on average, 37% of all heat-related deaths can be attributed directly to global warming. Senior author Antonio Gasparini, a professor of biostatistics and epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, told Agence France-Presse, climate change is not something in that distant future. We can already measure negative impacts on health, in addition to the known environmental and ecological effects. The authors of the report said that their methods, if extended worldwide, would add up to more than 100,000 heat-related deaths per year, laid squarely at the feet of man-made climate change. Number could be an underestimate because two of the regions for which data was largely missing, that is South Asia and Central Africa, are known to be especially vulnerable to extreme heat deaths. The 100,000 figure is consistent with a recent analysis from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluations, published in The Lancet. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluations calculated just over 300,000 heat-related deaths worldwide from all causes in 2019. If just over a third of those deaths are due to climate change, as Gasparini's team reported, the global total would indeed be more than 100,000. India accounted for more than a third of the total in the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation tally, and four of the five worst hit countries were in South Asia and in Central Africa. The share of heat-related deaths attributable to global warming in the new study varied widely from country to country. For example, in the United States, Australia, France, Britain, and Spain, that percentage was roughly in line with the average across all countries, between 35% and 39%. For Mexico, South Africa, Thailand, Vietnam, and Chile, the figure rose above 40%. And for half a dozen countries, Brazil, Peru, Colombia, the Philippines, Kuwait, and Guatemala, the percentage of heat-related mortality caused by climate change was 60% or more. A complex methodology combining health data and temperature records from 1991 to 2018, coupled with climate modeling, allowed researchers to contrast the actual number of heat-related deaths with how many fewer deaths there would have been without man-made global warming. Researchers found that it is not the increase in average summer temperature up to 1.5 degrees Celsius since 1991 in the locations examined that boosted death rates, but heat waves, how long they lasted, nighttime temperatures, and humidity levels. Also crucial is the ability of the population to adapt. If 95% of the population has air conditioning, mortality will be lower. But if they don't, or if farmers must work outside in 45 degrees centigrade, 130 degrees Fahrenheit heat to feed their families, the impacts can be catastrophic. Even wealthy nations remain vulnerable. In 2003, a relentless heat wave in Western Europe claimed 70,000 lives. Scientists warned deadly heat waves that might have occurred once a century before climate change kicked in could by mid-century happen far more frequently. For example, the burgeoning field of attribution climate science measures for how much a typhoon's intensity, a drought's duration, or a storm's surge destruction has been amplified by global warming. Dan Mitchell, a researcher at the Cabot Institute for the Environment at the University of Bristol in Western England, notes, but little research has tried to do the same for human health. Dan Mitchell said in a comment in Nature Climate Change, this shift in thinking is essential so that global leaders can understand the risks involved.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In his speech on the anniversary of the passing of Imam Khomeini on the 3rd of June 2020, Ayatollah Khamenei spoke about the transformations which Imam Khomeini brought about in Iran and the Iranian nation. By nature, Imam Khomeini was a person who advocated and brought about transformation. As for bringing about transformation, his role was not confined to being a mere teacher and instructor. Rather, he played the role of a commander active on the field and leading in the true sense of the word. First of all, he had the spirit of advocating transformation since long ago. This was not something that emerged in him at the beginning of the Islamic movement in the year 1962. Since his youth, he was an advocate of transformation. Evidence for this is the piece he wrote at the office of the late Waziri Yazdi in his youth, when he was in his 30s. Later on, the late Waziri Yazdi showed me the same writing. I have seen it published and many people have access to it today. In that essay, he quotes this holy ayah: I admonish you on one point, that you do stand up before Allah in pairs or singly. The Holy Quran, chapter 34, verse 46. This ayah invites the masses of people to rise for the sake of God. He had such a mentality. After that, he put his idea into practice, and as I mentioned, he carried out a transformation. He entered the arena of transformation in action, not just in words and in commands. Youth, during the time when the movement began to take shape, the Iranian nation was a nation that was not preoccupied with its fundamental issues. They had given up and they were passive. They did not have an opinion about their personal lives. There was no trace of dynamism, active presence and insistence on big and important issues in the behavior and conduct of our people. However, Imam arose these qualities in the people. He turned the same submissive and passive nation into a determined nation that pursued its demands. His inspiring, stirring, and stimulating speeches moved the people in a way that they turned into a people with demands. An example of this pursuance of demands is the events of the year 1341, according to the solar calendar, when the Islamic movement started, during which time the people held massive demonstrations in different cities, which ended in the events of 15th of Khordad. On the 15th of Khordad, despite a large-scale massacre, the regime could not extinguish the movement, and the people continued to stage uprisings until the end. That was an astonishing transformation that had been masterminded by Imam.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around 1,700 Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine have been arrested since the Israeli regime launched law and order in May, says Mustafa Abu Sneh, reporter, in an article titled "Israeli Regime Detains More Palestinian Citizens as Arrest Campaign Enters Second Week." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime police arrested more than six Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine, the latest roundup in a campaign that has seen 1,700 Palestinians picked up since early May, according to a committee monitoring the situation. Six people were arrested in Kafr Qana, a Palestinian town in the occupied Palestine north, while an as yet unknown number of Palestinians were taken into custody in northern towns of Arara and Araa, according to local media. Video footage circulated on social media showed the Zionist regime military police attacking Palestinians in Araa. Middle East Eye could not independently confirm the footage location and date. The arrests are part of the Zionist regime police mass arrest campaign called Law and Order, which began on May 24th after 2 weeks of protests in mixed cities against the Zionist regime settlement policies in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Emergency committee, which was formed in the wake of the protest in early May, said it has documented that in addition to the arrest of 1,700 Palestinians who reside in occupied Palestine, there have been 300 related cases of assault. Around 100 Palestinian citizens of occupied Palestine have been arrested daily since the campaign began, the committee said, and some of them were released later. The police launched the campaign after concluding that their power of deterrence had been severely damaged among the Palestinian community inside the occupied Palestine after confrontations in mixed cities including Lod, known as Lid to Palestinians, Acre, and Haifa. The Zionist regime police and media reports indicated that the crackdown, an attempt to reimpose deterrence, would last for 48 hours. It has instead continued over the past week. Several political leaders and activists have been swept up in the campaign and now face trials, including Kamal al-Khatib, vice president of the Islamic movement in the occupied Palestine, and a member of the Arab follow-up committee, who has been charged for incitement to so-called terrorism. Recently, a Zionist regime court extended the detention of two friends of Mohammad Kewan, a Palestinian from the northern town of Umm al-Fahm, who was shot by the Zionist regime police on May 12 and later succumbed to his wounds in a hospital in Haifa. The Zionist regime police accused Kewan's friends of attempting a car ramming operation near the junction of the Zionist town May Ami, about 2 kilometers from Umm al-Fahm. The lawyer for the two friends said the trial was political, according to local news site Arab 48. He asked the Zionist regime police to present the court with video footage from the May Ami junction. The police replied that cameras were not working at that time. Kewan was the second Palestinian citizen of the occupied Palestine to have been killed in May. In Lod, Musa Hasuna was also killed during a confrontation with far-right Israelis backed by settlers from the occupied West Bank. Human rights groups have condemned the mass arrest campaign of the occupied Palestine population of Palestinian citizens, that is about 1.9 million Palestinians, who descend from those who avoided the mass expulsion of Palestinians during the creation of the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and comprise one-fifth of this land's population. Recently, War on Want, lawyers for Palestinian human rights and Amnesty International sent a letter to UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, urging the British government to investigate patterns of serious violations and abuse by Israeli authorities, with particular attention to the right to life and the prohibition on torture and ill treatment under international human rights law. The rights group said that they have monitored various violations committed by Israeli regime authorities inside the occupied Palestine, the West Bank, and East Al-Quds. These violations include the Zionist regime's use of excessive force, arbitrary arrest of lawyers and human rights observers, arrest and detention of minors, and the blatant support of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu encouraging Israeli regime authorities to use an iron fist in the repression of protests, the letter said.
World with reporters. Organization of Iran, the red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition. Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. It's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming the cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding on to power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to